in most cases, when we are having some kind of encounter with another person, or even a even an animal in some cases, but when we're encountering life in the world, it's almost always colored by this emotional coloration that goes with it. For example, the same action, let's say that my wife makes me some coffee in the morning, right? And I may experience that action completely different depending on whether we read poetry just before that, the night before, or made love, or whether we had an argument that morning or the night before. In other words, the context provides this emotional coloring in terms of how I experience her making coffee. And when we do this kind of reflection, what we're really trying to do is to set aside that emotional coloring.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't checked it out yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, links to books written by our guests, TED Talks, and much more. So that way, you don't have to scramble to find all the things that we reference during an episode. And when our first book comes out in August, that's where we'll be announcing all the pre-order bonuses. So visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter to learn more. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. A few episodes ago, I mentioned an article that I read online about the keys to getting hired in the 21st century, and one of those was to have a website. There's not a single job application you'll ever fill out that doesn't ask for this. And really, why would you limit your self-expression to nothing but a resume, especially if you're a creative person? If you want to stand out in a sea of noise, you have to give people a reason to find you interesting. So consider starting an online project of some sort. The truth is that a side project can end up turning into something that changes your life or your career. Dozens of side projects are ultimately what led us to start The Unmistakable Creative. Even if it's nothing but a simple website with some info about who you are and what's important to you, it's an important first step, and our friends at HostGator can help you get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email that's incredibly reliable, a website builder that's easy to use if you're not too tech savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you want to get your hands dirty. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering 30% off all their hosting packages. So whether you're looking for a place to showcase your projects or you just need to start a personal brand, HostGator is perfect. Visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative. Greg, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, it is really great to have you here. You know, I came across your story actually by way of somebody in your organization who wrote in to tell me a little bit about what you do, and I was immediately intrigued and very curious about it. But today I want to start the show a little bit differently than we normally do, and I want to start by asking you what the earliest memory you have from childhood it is that you feel has ultimately led to where you're at and what you're doing today.
Well, the earliest memory that has actually had some influence, at least as far as I know, on what I'm doing. though I can probably remember a few things that go back to even when I was maybe 3 or 4, probably the most poignant memory that I have and one of the most powerful memories that has influenced me was when I was about 8 to 9 years old. I had a younger brother who was 3 years younger than me. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, had diabetes. She was living in a nursing home, and she had first one leg and then her second leg amputated. So my mother was kind of sandwiched in between trying to take care of two young boys and trying to attend to her mother, who was very severely ill. And when my mother would want to go visit her in the nursing home, she would kind of call her kids and said, "We're going to go visit grandma." But I didn't want to go. And I was an athlete, and I wanted to be playing with my friends and playing basketball and playing baseball and doing fun things. I didn't like the nursing home. I didn't like how it smelled. I didn't like all the old people who were there. And so I would not only not cooperate, but I would really resist things. I would pout. I would argue. Sometimes I would cry or make excuses or pretend to be sick. In other words, I would cause a great deal of difficulty to my mother in terms of trying to for her trying to get us to go on this visit to grandma in the nursing home. And when I first remembered this, and I remember this during a retreat that I did many years ago in Japan, where you would spend about 15 hours a day facing a blank wall and going back and actually remembering your life in specific stages and in relation to specific people. And hopefully I'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But that's when I first kind of thought of this. I was in my 30s at the time. And the first time I remembered it, I actually felt a little bit bad. But I thought, well, I was only 8 years old. It's really, what do you expect from an 8-year-old? But it was probably at my second or third retreat when I remembered the same memory, but I remembered it in a very different way. And I realize now that what was different about it was the first time that I was able to put myself in my mother's shoes, in the sense that I wasn't remembering that incident exclusively from my perspective, but I actually felt like I had a sense of what that was like for her. And during that experience, when I actually remembered it, feeling like I was putting myself in her shoes, it had a tremendous impact on me emotionally. I really felt it in my body. I actually cried at that point in the retreat, because I realized that her experience was probably such a struggle trying to balance this obligation to both her kids and to her mom, and then having her oldest son create this kind of experience every time she wanted to go there. And so it just broke my heart to think that I had caused her that kind of suffering. And as I say that, some of your listeners might think, you know, it's a bad thing that I'm feeling guilty and I'm feeling bad. But actually, it was a wonderful thing, because it gave me a sense of what it was like for my mom to deal with me as a child, whereas my normal perspective, not just as a kid, but into my 30s, was always, what is it like for me to have this person as my mom? Which, of course, opened up all kinds of possible ways for me to complain and criticize the way she had raised me or the way she had treated me. So the result of that was that it changed, that and other memories really changed my relationship with my mother. I felt I could really now look at a relationship that had been very tense and conflicted for decades in a much different way. It softened my heart towards her. I actually wrote her a thank you note after that particular retreat. First time in my life I actually wrote her anything like that. And it turned our relationship into something very different. Not some perfect mother-son relationship, and it wasn't without its difficulties. But we were able to basically have a relationship as mother and son in a way that I think ended up for the next 30-some years. My mother just died actually a few months ago in hospice. And for the next 30-some years, we were able to have a very different relationship than we would have had if it wasn't for that memory and memories like those.
Hmm. In our own lives, when we look back on memories, especially painful ones of people who have hurt us, how do we develop the capacity to see things from their perspective?
It's a good question. You know, that how do we develop the capacity to put ourselves in another person's shoes? You know, whether it be our husband or wife or an aging parent or someone we work with it in our work setting. You know, how do we actually get outside of our normal perspective as we go through the day, in many cases with this experience that we're the center of the world, that everything kind of revolves around our experience? How do we get out of that and put ourselves in another person's shoes? And one of the interesting things about that question is that, I remember years ago listening to an NPR episode, and they were talking with M. Scott Peck, a well-known author, at least at the time, who had wrote this book called The Road Less Traveled. And they were asking him about good and evil. And I found that the way he defined evil, if you think there is such a thing, but the way he defined it was fascinating to me, because he defined evil as the inability to put ourselves in another person's shoes. The inability to put ourselves in another person's shoes. And so if you accept that just for the sake of discussion, then it's really important that we develop that capacity, you know, to basically see things through the eyes of another person and to be able to shift our perspectives. So instead of my looking at my mother and thinking, what is it like for me to have this woman as my mother, that I can basically turn that around and say, what is it like for my mother to actually have someone like me as a son? Mm-hmm. And that to me is like opening the door to what I consider to be the process of self-reflection, the process of really examining ourselves, examining our conduct in the world, examining the way that we're living. And by doing so, it opens up possibilities for how we can make changes and how we might be able to do things different and live differently, and even opens up possibilities that take us all the way into the spiritual realm or religious realm of faith. So it's a very important door to open. And in terms of how we do it, I don't know that there's a mathematical equation in terms of how to get there.
Yeah.
But I would say from my personal experience, the most important thing is practice. In other words, we somehow get the sense that this is something important that we need to do in our lives. And we begin doing it. And just like with most things, we're not very good in the beginning. But the more we practice reflecting on ourselves and our lives and our relationships, I think the more likely it is that we're able to put ourselves in the other person's shoes.
So how do you separate like very strong emotions towards a person? Like let's say somebody who's hurt you or somebody who has betrayed you in some way, and you feel just like horrible things towards them, and yet you want to put yourself in their shoes. Do you understand my question? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and the process that I'm describing to you actually has a The process that I'm describing to you actually has a Japanese name. It's called Nikon. We pronounce it like we actually kind of mispronounce the camera, Nikon, spelled N-A-I-K-A-N. And in Japanese or in English, it means something like inside looking or looking from the inside. And when I first began studying this process, which was really a question of studying it through my own personal experience and my own personal life, one of the things that I learned was that in most cases, when we are having some kind of encounter with another person or even an animal in some cases, but when we're encountering life in the world, it's almost always colored by this emotional coloration that goes with it. For example, the same action, let's say that my wife makes me some coffee in the morning, right? And I may experience that action completely different depending on whether we read poetry just before that, the night before, or made love, or whether we had an argument that morning or the night before. In other words, the context provides this emotional coloring in terms of how I experience her making coffee. And when we do this kind of reflection, what we're really trying to do is to set aside that emotional coloring, to just look objectively as much as we can at the facts of the situation. The facts in that example being, I received a cup of coffee from my wife. Right? How I felt about that or what I felt towards her is really my subjective experience that comes from that encounter. But the fact of the situation that is very clear when I set aside that emotional coloring is I received a cup of coffee from her. And so I think that so part of this process is to essentially give people a structured method of reflection that encourages them, almost requires them to set aside their feelings and emotions towards this other person to just look at the facts of the situation.
Hmm. So what in the world led you down the path of seeking this kind of work and this journey? I mean, talk to me about all of that, like from where you started as a kid to where you're at today.
Well, I grew up in a family where there were mixed religions. My mother was Jewish and my father was Catholic. And there was a fair amount of conflict through the extended families about the differences in those religions. And so I never really had a very positive view of religion as I grew up in my family. We were exposed both to Judaism and Catholicism, but I basically associated as with a source of conflict. And so when I got into college, I became interested in Buddhism. And that interest grew. I became interested in meditation and ultimately was very fortunate to actually find some wonderful teachers who were Buddhist teachers, both here and ultimately in Japan. And I think that that's kind of what pulled me into the work that I'm doing now, because for many years in the field that I was in, excuse me, for many years in the field that I was in, which was organizational psychology, I had an interest in clinical psychology. But when I would go into a bookstore and look at the psychology books on the shelves, things like Looking Out for Number One or How to Get the Love You Want, and then I would look at that next to these wonderful spiritual principles I was learning in terms of studying Buddhism and Eastern philosophy, things like selflessness and service and compassion, and it always seemed like a mismatch. It always seemed like Western psychology had a great focus on self-centeredness, that it was almost the essence of Western psychology. So I never was really drawn to it until I stumbled on a book in a bookstore by a man named David Reynolds that was on Japanese psychology. And I read that, and it was such a good fit for me in terms of where I was at in my life at that time, being interested in Japan, studying Buddhism. And here was an approach, actually several approaches to psychology, that really drew on these principles from Eastern philosophy and Asia and Japan and Buddhism, and made perfect sense to me compared to what I had been exposed to in terms of Western psychology. So that kind of lit this little fire in me to get more involved, and ultimately, you know, led me to study actually for a few years with the author of that book, with David, and then go off to Japan and do additional work and study over a period of years, off and on in Japan. And ultimately, I made this my life's work in 1992. I moved to Vermont with Linda, who then later became my wife, and we founded a center here in Vermont that is really the only place in North America that kind of teaches this type of work to people. We have retreats and programs and online programs. But a lot of it really comes back to discovering that there was approaches to psychology that were grounded in a very different view of how the world is and how the world is supposed to be, that really came from Asia and Buddhism, as opposed to Western psychology, which almost always is traced back to European roots.
So before we get into the principles that you guys talk about, I want to ask you one other question. You know, given the importance of these kinds of topics in our lives, why do you think we're not exposed to them so much earlier? Like, why is it that nobody sits you down in high school and asks you to start considering things like greater meaning or greater purpose in life? Do you think we're just not mature enough to be able to contemplate things like that?
Well, you know, it's a good question in terms of why it isn't more a bigger part of our educational system. Mm-hmm. And I think on the one hand, I think it's because in the public school system, we have such a taboo on introducing religion, except in the most extremely objective ways, you know, and so kids who basically grow up and go to school in the public school system, which I did, really have very little exposure. The idea is that, you know, religion is supposed to be something you learn at home or in church. My daughters were in public school and homeschooled until high school, and they're now in a Catholic school, even though, as I mentioned before, I've basically been involved in Buddhism for three decades. But what I find in a Catholic school, which is even though they have their own take, of course, on religion and Catholicism, is the topic of faith, of belief, is opened up, right? And depending on who the teacher is, that they may be more or less open to what people think. But for my kids, it's actually opened up questions that they have that wouldn't have gotten raised, I think, in the public school system. The second thing that I see that I think is changing in both public and private school is a shift towards seeing character education, qualities like, for example, gratitude, qualities like empathy, self-reflection, self-control, seeing those qualities as things that actually need to be considered as an important part of a child's education in school, not simply just developing cognitive skills or subject matter like math and science and English. So I think there's a shift moving in that direction in our school system. Mm-hmm. I don't really think there's a shift moving in the direction of spirituality, but I do think there's a shift moving in that direction in terms of character education. But without those two things, most of our exposure is really towards cognitive development and studying, you know, kind of traditional content. And these kinds of questions of meaning and purpose and gratitude and faith don't really get addressed, except maybe in a particular single class at the high school level. But mostly, they just don't get addressed in our educational system.
Yeah. Well, you know, I even wonder, you know, at the college level, why we're not exposed to these. I mean, I had my friend Cal Newport here a few months back, and he said, you know, I think there's a reason you're finding interest from college instructors in what you're talking about here on the show. He said, because if you looked at a classical education prior to sort of the modern education system that is the byproduct of an industrial revolution, living a meaningful life, living a life of distinction, you actually spent time thinking about that and working on that in college. And I can tell you, I can't remember one moment in college where something like this ever crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's a missing piece. There's no question about it. And then if you think about what happens then is that people get a public education, kids get a public education, they go off to college, maybe to graduate school, and they go out into the world, and they may be brilliant computer programmers, and they may be brilliant astronomers or wonderful wildlife biologists. But then you get in a relationship with somebody, right? In terms of an intimate relationship, or your parents start getting older and you find that you're dealing with questions of how do you deal with, you know, your aging parents. And because there's been no exposure to some of the concepts that we've been mentioning, mm-hmm. You really have no experience and you've got no guidance in terms of how to work with those things. And so at least some percentage of the population turns to counseling and psychotherapy. But the thing about counseling and psychotherapy from a Western standpoint is that it also has a long tradition of staying away from anything that has to do with spirituality or religion. Mm. So you end up in a very secular setting, even though a lot of people who are struggling in their life will say that things like faith or their religious beliefs are an important part of that. But in a counseling session, it's unlikely to come up, or it's unlikely that the counselor actually has any training in working with that kind of idea. So I think we leave people struggling a lot in our culture because we don't provide guidance or direction to people in terms of some of what you might call these softer areas that don't have to do with the practical aspects of living and working and the vocation that one chooses.
There's more on my conversation with Greg after this message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by TrueCar. There's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know. Using TrueCar can also help you to buy a used car. In fact, there are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So whether you're looking to buy a new or used car, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers discounts off the list price for used cars and a better car buying experience through the TrueCar certified dealer network. You can see what other people have paid for the car you want, so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick and easy buying experience. There are 11,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. And using the TrueCar website or TrueCar app, you can easily find the new or used car you want. And over 2 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar certified dealer network. You'll work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer contact, and TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off the manufacturer's suggested retail price. And to add to that, here's a little psychology lesson. You might remember that the average person makes over 300 decisions a day. So using an app like TrueCar can actually help reduce your decision fatigue and make you more productive. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Our other sponsor for today is HostGator. So I want to talk to you about something that I think is really important. Most of us get caught up in really big wins and big achievements, so we don't take time to appreciate our smaller day-to-day achievements. But the research of Harvard professor Teresa Amabile shows that visible progress can be incredibly meaningful to us. And you're probably wondering what the heck this has to do with HostGator. Well, by starting an online project that you work on every single day, you create a mechanism for visible progress. And that starts to create a ripple effect through the rest of your life. It's a bit like what happens when you start running every day and you suddenly feel compelled to change your diet and a whole bunch of other things about your life. So even if you have no aspirations to build some sort of internet empire, consider starting an online project of some sort. It can be really, really helpful. And the truth is that a side project can end up turning into something that changes your life or career. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, dozens of side projects are ultimately what led us to starting The Unmistakable Creative. And even if it's nothing but a simple website with some info about who you are and what's important to you, it can be a really powerful first step. And our friends at HostGator can help you get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. A website builder that's easy to use if you're not tech savvy, and one-click WordPress installs. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering 30% off all their hosting packages. So whether you're looking for a place to showcase your projects or you just need to start a personal brand, HostGator is perfect. Visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off. Now, back to my conversation with Greg. So one question about the period working as an organizational psychologist, what did you learn from organizational psychology that you apply to your work today?
I think probably one of the areas that was most helpful to me was in the area of teamwork. And I think in terms of my work today, what I see is that most of us have to work in some kind of a team setting, even if we're independent, even if you're an independent contractor or a consultant, you're probably working at some level on a team basis with other people. And I think that learning how to be an effective team member within an organizational setting has some real similarities to learning how to be effective within a particular community, within a family setting. You know, those are all, and even within a sports team setting, I think those are all variations on what it means to be part of a team. And I think that, again, we all often don't have good models for that in terms of our childhood. And so we get into work settings and we kind of have to figure out for the first time how to do that effectively.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's actually get into the meat of your work and these principles and practices and philosophies that have really shaped what you do. And I'd love for you to talk about the self-reflection component as well as the other piece through the lens of your own stories and your own experiences with it.
All right. Well, we can start with self-reflection, which I mentioned, the term that's used in Japan is called Nikon. I can remember this fairly vividly, which was being in Japan. I had been in Japan before, but specifically going there to do my first retreat and changing trains in Nagoya, which is a big, busy train station, getting on this little train out to a little town called Kuwana, small little train station, getting off the train, looking around, having no idea where I was. Fortunately, getting picked up by this, I was in my 30s, this young Japanese man who was probably in his early 20s and who spoke English, and then being driven for 20 or 30 minutes into these rice paddies and ultimately to a place that was a Buddhist temple that also functioned as a Nikon center where people can go and do this reflection. the man who was in charge of the center, in this case, was a Buddhist priest. Basically, I was given a space in a large hall with two little screens on my right and left and some cushions to sit on and a kind of blank wall to face. And then for the next 2 weeks, I really went through my life looking at both segments in terms of years of my life and individual relationships. So, for example, traditionally, you would always start with reflection on your mother, and I would look at reflecting on my mother from the time I was born, at least as early as I could remember, until I was 6 years old. And I was asked, you know, to look at three questions, which was during that period of time, what did I receive from my mother? What did I give to her during that same period of time? And what troubles and difficulties did I cause her? I used those three questions as a way of structuring my reflection. And I'd have about 2 hours. And at the end of 2 hours, someone would come and they'd ask me what I remembered. And I would just simply answer those questions. I remembered receiving from my mom that she took me to swimming lessons, that she encouraged me to practice the piano when I was young, that she got me my first job as kind of a little kid stuffing papers at an all-night pharmacy, which is where she worked. And so I would remember these very practical, specific things, and then I would look at what I gave to her, which during my early years was really very little or nothing. And then the troubles and difficulties that I caused her, which again were extensive, particularly for a young kind of a rebellious kid in his early childhood years. And then I'd move on to the next three-year period and the next three-year period until I basically got all the way through my life until the present day of my life. And then I would reflect on my father. And then over time, I reflected on ex-girlfriends. I reflected on my grandparents, on my younger brother, on teachers and on best friends that I had. Coaches, actually, someone who was really influential who coached me in basketball during my junior high school years. So everybody who was playing a key role in my life, I had a chance to really step back, look at this period of time, a few years at a time, look at these questions, what did I receive from this person, what did I give to them, and what troubles and difficulties did I cause? and over the course of 2 weeks, I had a chance to really construct a film of how I had lived my life from as far back as I could remember up until the present day. It wasn't kind of a smooth film like what you know, watch when you go to the movie theaters. It was very choppy, but it had very discrete little video segments of incidents and encounters and joy and sadness. And ultimately, that became the story that I left that center with. And a number of years later, probably about 3 years later, when I was actually starting to write a book about Nikon, it was a time when they released a movie, and you may or may not remember this, but it was a movie called Defending Your Life with Meryl Streep and Albert Brooks. And mostly it was a comedy. And if you can still get a hold of it, I would really recommend it to people. Right in the beginning of the movie, I won't give away too much. Right in the beginning of the movie, Albert Brooks dies in a car accident. And he's taken to this place, which is kind of like a temporary place that you go until they, and it's not clear who they are, but they, the powers that be, decide whether you're going to move forward or you're going to go back to Earth and have a new life and try again. And so he's in this temporary place. And one of the main exercises that they do to make this decision is they actually bring you into a room that's almost like a courtroom, and you actually have a representative that's almost like an attorney, and you present scenes from your life where in which you did things that you're very proud of, you know. So, you know, maybe you your brother was drowning and you saved his life at one point, or maybe you there was a bug that got caught in a web and you let him go, or maybe you just did something great on a sports team. You scored the winning basket and then in the state championship. So you present these scenes where you're very proud of how you lived, but then scenes are presented to you that you have to watch where you're not so proud, where you did things that were selfish, where you did things that were mean, where you lost your temper and maybe yelled or was angry at people. Maybe you cheated in certain ways. And you now actually watch these scenes from your life. And it was fascinating for me to watch that film because it was very similar in theme from what I had gone through in my retreat. You know, watching these little edited segments, video segments of my life. And in the movie, they're using that as a basis for deciding where you go from here because you're already dead. And so I felt when I got out of this retreat that I actually did have a new chance at life, that I had looked at my life in at least as sincere and honest way as I could at the time. I had seen some things I did that I really was ashamed of, that I really wasn't proud of. I had seen how selfish I was, but I had also seen how loved and supported I was. I saw how much my parents had done for me. Instead of thinking for so many years how they had neglected me and done such a poor job as my parents, and instead I saw, you know, all the wonderful privileges that I had as a kid and everything that was given to me in terms of transportation and school and books and swimming lessons and piano lessons, and I could just go on and on. It was a very long list. It gave me a very deep sense of appreciation for my parents. It gave me a very deep sense of gratitude towards lots of these key people in my life, friends, coaches. And it also gave me a sense of remorse and guilt for some of the things I had done in terms of ex-girlfriends, in terms of other people in my life, even my parents. But the sense that now that I had seen those things, there was the possibility of moving forward in my life in a different way than I had lived up to that point. So that was really the beginning of my work in that field, but it was a very personal beginning. And I think it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this work, because it really did send my life in a very different direction, that where I'm living, the woman I'm married to, the job I have in terms of running the center, the books that I've written, my kids, all of this really I can trace back to this shift that occurred when I spent those 2 weeks in Japan kind of stepping back and reflecting on my life.
So how do we incorporate something like this into our lives without having to go to a retreat center in Japan?
Well, fortunately, it's not something that is necessary in order to incorporate some kind of reflective practice in your life. And I think that, you know, a lot of people now, probably a lot of your listeners, have some kind of exercise program, right, that you do, whether it's once a week or five times a week. It may be yoga, it may be running or jogging or biking, but many people now have decided it's important to have exercise as one key element of their routine during the course of a week. And I think, you know, we see that in exercise, and we see it in other areas of our life, including things like social media. But what we don't see is very many people who are building in a practice of self-reflection, who are setting aside even a small amount of time on a daily or even weekly basis to step back and reflect on how they've lived. And so that's, I think, where we can start. You don't have to start by going off to Japan or even coming here to Vermont and doing a week-long retreat. You can start by just basically taking a few minutes before you go to bed and using those same three questions in what's called daily Nikon or daily reflection. So you look back on your day at the end of today when you're getting ready for bed or even in bed. You just have a little piece of paper or notebook and you use those same three questions and you write down everything you can think of that you received that day. So right now I'm receiving the use of my computer. I'm receiving the the use of Wi-Fi in terms of having this discussion with you. I'm receiving your time and attention and questions from you that allow me to talk about work that I feel very passionate about. I'm actually receiving heat from my house because I live in Vermont, and outside right now it's about 40 degrees. So I'm receiving the benefit of heat. I have eyeglasses on. I'm receiving that as helping me with my sight. So these are very practical things I'm talking about, not some grandiose conceptual idea. And we list those things. And then the second question, what did I give today? What did I give to others, right? I fed my dog today. I took him out for a walk. I made a cup of tea for my wife. I answered an email for someone who wrote to me with a question. And so I have a list of things that I've given. And then finally, this third question, which is often the most difficult question for us to face, which is what troubles and difficulties have I caused to others, right? And so if I was late for an appointment, or if I wasted food because I left it in the refrigerator too long and ended up having to throw it out, if I drove, even just driving my kids to school requires me to pollute the air, right? So looking at things we did, things that we said, the way we handled ourselves throughout the day, and how did that cause trouble or difficulty for others? And that's really a structure for reflecting on your day. And you can do that in somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes in the evening. And if you do it, you know, every night or every other night or even over the weekend on the week, it adds this element to your life of being able to reflect on yourself and how you're living. And it allows you to step back from getting caught up into the day-to-day kind of busyness of life, where we're so caught up in what we're doing that we don't really step back and ask ourselves these bigger questions of, am I doing this with integrity? How are other people supporting me? Is there something I need to be doing for others? What kind of values am I bringing to my work? How is what I'm doing actually hurting people or causing them trouble? So without self-reflection, it's very easy for us to just basically go through the day and go through our day and do the best we can, and at the end of the day feel kind of wiped out or tired or even maybe successful. But it's very hard for us to make any fundamental changes if we don't at some point step back and look at how we're living. And it's one of the reasons that I started a retreat center, was to have a place where people could do that.
So we've talked about the Nikon piece. What about the Shomomurita piece?
Well, the other element of Japanese psychology that I was introduced to was something called Murita therapy, which is often referred to the action side of Japanese psychology. And Murita is actually the name of a Japanese psychiatrist who lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, who developed an approach initially towards dealing with anxiety that basically was based on people learning how to cope with their feelings and internal experience without shifting their energy towards always trying to fix themselves. In other words, maybe I can best represent this with just kind of a simple example that someone has to make a presentation in front of a group. And many of us are very anxious and nervous about standing up in front of a group and speaking publicly. So we start feeling anxious. We may have manifestations of that anxiety in terms of sweaty palms or sweaty forehead, or we feel a kind of tension in our stomach or shoulders. And more traditional approaches would basically say that you would use self-talk or some other methods to try to get yourself to feel confidence, to do affirmations and try to feel like you can do this, you're successful, you know what you're talking about. So essentially what you're doing is you're trying to change your internal state from, let's say, anxiety to comfort and confidence. The problem is that for many people who have tried to do that, you find that your scorecard isn't that great, that a lot of times actually you can't do it. You might be able to do it a little bit or temporarily, but we start with the premise in Murita therapy that your emotions and your feelings are primarily uncontrollable by your will. If you feel depressed, you can't will yourself to feel happy. You just can't. If you feel anxious, you can't will yourself to feel confident. And so what is the alternative to trying to work on your inner experience to change it? And the alternative is essentially to accept it. In other words, if you feel anxious, you accept the fact that you're feeling anxious. You don't do anything to try to fix or change your internal experience. But instead, what you do is you shift your attention to something constructive, in the example I'm using, which is how can you prepare for your talk? So instead of trying to fix your feeling state, you're actually trying to make sure that you go into that talk really knowing the material you have, really knowing the content, maybe even anticipating certain questions. So there's a shift from trying to work on your feelings towards trying to basically have a constructive response to the situation that you're in. And that means you go into that situation feeling anxious. But what we find is that in many cases, once you're in the situation, the one that stimulated that anxiety, once you're actually involved in it and you're immersed in it and your attention is on what you're doing instead of on your feeling state, you no longer feel anxiety because you're no longer focusing on your internal state. You're focusing on what you need to do in the situation. So this becomes a very different approach that comes from the East. It's much more consistent with, for instance, Zen meditation, where your instructions are to sit in a very still kind of way and to focus on your breath and maybe even to count your breath. And as you're meditating, if you find that thoughts pop up into your mind, which they almost always do, your instructions from your teacher are often to notice those thoughts, accept them, and simply bring your attention back to your breath. Right? So in other words, we don't give the stage to those thoughts or feelings, whatever they are. We simply notice them, accept them, and then shift our attention back to our breathing. And that's a very kind of simple but traditional approach to meditation in a lot of traditions, including Zen, which was my early training. And we're essentially asking people to do something very similar. In fact, teaching people to do something very similar. When you find yourself in a situation in which you feel anxious or you feel fearful or you feel shy or lonely or any one of those uncomfortable feelings, to just notice that feeling state, notice the thoughts that come with it, accept them. But instead of shifting your attention back to your breath, shift your attention to the circumstances you're in and what you need to be doing at that moment. And so it's a very different approach. It comes from a very different kind of philosophical foundation than you would find in more traditional approaches to Western therapy.
Is it something that has to be practiced in order to get good at it?
I actually think that's pretty much true of anything, right. That we always need to practice to get good at it. And this is no exception. But I think one of the things I do believe is that by practicing certain skills, and in the model that I have that comes from Japanese psychology, there's four different skills. One of them is self-reflection, which I've talked about. The one we're talking about now is called coexisting with your internal experience or coexisting with uncomfortable feelings. Another skill is working successfully with your attention. And the fourth skill is acceptance. And the more we practice those skills, the more we get better at them. And I would suggest that actually those skills make up the heart of what we should be thinking of as mental health. In other words, if we become competent at those four skills, at accepting things, at working with our attention, coexisting with our internal experience, but taking constructive action and self-reflection, if we become good at that, that addresses, I think, the vast majority of mental health problems and issues that we face in our life. And if we start looking at mental health as something that is a skill and can be learned, we take it out of the model of something that's kind of a part of us, a part of our personality or personality disorder or something that is a diagnosis that we have that's treated as a disease, which in many cases the suggestion is that we have to be on medication or that there's very little that we can do about that unless we're in therapy for a long time. But here's a model of mental health that comes from Japanese psychology that really says we can actually learn to be skillful in these areas that then produce the experience of positive mental health for us.
Well, I think that makes just a really beautiful way to wrap up our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I would say authenticity. To me, that's almost necessary for something to be thought of as unmistakable, is that it's authentic. And there's a wonderful little poem that comes from the Zen tradition about a maple leaf And it's a simple poem about a maple leaf. You can imagine the fall foliage here in Vermont. We have maple trees. Here's this beautiful colored maple leaf. And it's in this moment where it detaches from the branch and it begins to fall. And as it falls, it's spinning, right? So that as you watch it fall, if you could actually catch this in slow motion, you see that you can actually see both sides of that maple leaf, the front and the back. And that's authenticity. Authenticity is when we go through our life and we present ourselves in the world and we're not trying to hide the backside, but we're basically presenting who we really are and what we really are. And we're not, there's no energy or investment towards trying to present a particular persona or image to others. But this is how we are. Just like that maple leaf, when you encounter this person, you're encountering everything about them without any energy that they're using to try to hide a part of them. And to me, when you encounter someone like that or something like that, then they're unmistakable.
Awesome. Well, this has been really, really thought-provoking and eye-opening, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your stories and your insights with our listeners at The Unmistakable Creative.
Well, I enjoyed speaking with you. You have a wonderful show. I've listened to several of your other shows. I feel very honored to be a guest on this show, and I wish you the best of luck in terms of moving forward with your own life and developing your own contribution to the world.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Wednesday on The Unmistakable Creative.
Business-related relationships are often a reflection of just circumstance. Like, you know, we have these relationships with people who work down the hall from us or who, you know, we used to work with or they're in, you know, in our industry, rather than being really intentional about it. And one of the things that I advocate everyone to do is put together what I call your conversations list, which is a list of the 50 people who you'd like to build or deepen a relationship with over the course of the next 12 months. And what that does is it gives you a roadmap. It gives you a list of people who you should really be focusing your energies on because you see them as being critical to your business moving forward, your career moving forward.
Former White House staff writer and attorney John Corcoran joins us to talk about how we go from relationships to revenue.